seeds on.
Welcome back to Kyronite. Stacy, this has been a lot of the conversation post-Seahawks win last second win.
It was a thriller.
It was a thriller. It didn't need to be, but it certainly was. A lot of talk is about the Seahawks and defensive side of the football injuries, but it seems to be rampant all over the place. I know that the 49ers have taken an egregious number of injuries. First of all, who on the 49ers now, given that that's a division rival, who on the 49ers actually are out now?
So they lost a couple players for the season, and then they have a couple guys that are going to be injured for at least a couple weeks, or at the very least have their status for this upcoming week in question. Now, Seattle isn't playing the 49ers until I think like maybe early November. I need to double check, but I think it might not be until like after their bye. Their first NFC West opponent is going to be the Arizona Cardinals, so it'll be a while before Seattle faces off against the 49ers. But 49ers lost their star defensive end Nick Bosa to a torn ACL injury.
That's a huge loss.
Essentially like the next play, they lost Solomon Thomas, who's another defensive starter for them on what was the second best defense in the league last year, right behind New England. I think certainly the best defensive front seven in the league. And they have obviously have already placed Richard Sherman on the injured reserve list. When you hear injured reserve list, you normally think season ending, but this year in particular, it's going to be a little bit different. You only have to be on it for 3 weeks. So that doesn't mean that Richard Sherman's done for the season. On the offensive side of the ball, they have both of their starting running backs, Raheem Mostert and Tevin Coleman, are injured. Neither of those sound season ending, the last update that we heard, but certainly ones that are concerning for the team. Jimmy Garoppolo, their quarterback, has a high ankle sprain. He is expected to play next week, but with a high ankle sprain, I think that's certainly questionable.
Yeah, and those things also tend to linger. They're
absolutely
very difficult to recover from except by just sitting still for a period of time.
Exactly. They have obviously a number of wide receivers that have been injured. It's just, no matter if it's, you know, a division rival or not, your heart goes out for guys that are injured. And I just can't believe that one team has had so many. I mean, it is heartbreaking and tough, no matter who you root for.
And for me, I always, you know, I grew up a Raiders fan. And one of the things that you remember most when you're a kid and a fan, when you're in those formative years where it seems like the seasons lasted 9 months and that this rivalry extended your entire childhood, and you go back and look like, oh, that was only 3 years. But I was a little jealous when I came up here, well, when the Seahawks got very good and I was up here. I like the Seahawks a lot. They'd probably rank, you know, maybe my second favorite team. The Seahawks 49ers rivalry was so ridiculously fun. Mm-hmm. Coaches didn't like each other. Players didn't like each other. It was a blast, and it ended all too soon. And then it seemed like now it was on a comeback. Like this was going to be again this big rivalry. And that's my main hope. Like for me, that's when football gets its most fun. When you have an opponent, you have to play a couple of times a year. You know you're going to meet in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff to me is what builds sort of memory, and it actually really deepens your level of you know, I don't know, your devotion to a team.
Exactly.
And your lifetime devotion to a team are those rivalries that you go through with your team. And I like to see the Niners good. I mean, because I think that makes the Seahawks better. And I love the fact that it really focuses the season.
It's exactly that. It's that thing of like, in Bring It On. This is the worst comparison, but I always think of this. I know you are too, Mike.
The funny thing is, I just was looking at a Then and Now. I actually thought Bring It On was great.
Bring It On is a phenomenal movie.
It's a really great movie.
It's completely underrated.
I agree with you.
It's
actually way
comedy.
Smarter than it needed
for.
To be.
Yes. Yeah. One of the kind of like, not insults, but one of the shots fired essentially like by one cheerleading squad to the next is that they want to beat them at their best.
Right.
So it's like, well, it doesn't matter if you guys aren't in it. Like, we want to beat you. I think that that's probably kind of the mentality of teams too, is you
totally
want to be like, I don't want to beat you because you know, duck out or you're injured or you're gone. Like, I want to beat you at your best. And that's when rivalries are good.
Right.
When both teams are at their best, not when one team is dominating. That said, I don't expect the 49ers to just like fall to the bottom of the league. I know that these are huge, 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 huge injuries, but this team had a lot of depth. I mean, when you're making it to a Super Bowl, you got a lot of depth on your team, obviously, no matter what, because you are going to have injuries over the course of a season. It's inevitable. It's an incredibly physical game, and it happens. And some of those end up ending your season. I think that these are more dire injuries than they've had certainly last year, because you've got starters down, not just starters, but incredibly impactful starters. I mean, the loss of Nick Bosa is huge.
That's he's as good as it gets on the defensive side of the ball right now in the
right
league.
And that said, I mean, they still finished out their win against the Jets. I know it's the Jets, but the run game still looks strong, and it doesn't sound like either running back will be out for a long, long period of time. So again, like, it is possible that this team will be much healthier by the time they face Seattle, and that the offensive side of the ball can still be dangerous. And I know that was seen as the weaker side of the ball for San Francisco, but it's certainly not like a weak unit league-wide.
Set football aside.
Okay.
Here's the story I really want to talk about. So what is going on with... Well, we talked about this once before, the idea of a Chicago radio host criticizing the attire of an ESPN reporter in really derogatory terms, getting canned as a result, and then the subsequent, yes, he should have been canned, the backlash against him getting canned. Where are we at with this one now? It seems to have just continued living on.
It does. It has, very unfortunately, through a just poorly written article. It was an article about Maria Taylor by someone that I don't care to mention.
I'll mention him.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's Jason Whitlock, who, you know, I struggle with Jason Whitlock because I think he is a supremely substandard reporter. I mean, in a really kind of remarkable way. And I'm worried, and I don't try to conflate the two, but I'm worried he may be also a substandard person. But I'm more concerned about him being a reporter. I don't know about anything about him as a person.
So Jason Whitlock has this thing that he's calling beauty privilege, which is... he wrote an article about Maria Taylor and said, hey, you know, she has her job in part because she's tall and pretty, but she's also, you know, good at her job. And the way that she'll remain successful is by not taking herself too seriously, which in itself is incredibly insulting. But in that, he also took a completely unnecessary shot at Katie Nolan, who's another public figure in sports. And he said, quote, beauty transformed Katie Nolan from bartender, which, first of all, saying someone's a bartender is not an insult.
I would agree.
To seven-figure personality and the darling of a aroused bloggers and TV critics willing to ignore her pedestrian humor and inability to execute live television. And I really liked Katie Nolan's response. And he since wrote this like awful piece targeting her after this, but
you mean that wasn't enough?
No. She said, you're this close to making an actual point about the expectation of women to not only be good at their job, but also beautiful, but actual points don't pay the bills, huh? So the thing that I liked about that is that I hear as criticism, whether it was during the conversation about Maria Taylor, whether it's a conversation about Aaron Andrews, about women in sports, particularly women in forward-facing jobs, right, where you're seeing them, that, oh, they got there because they're beautiful. And someone else who is talented but not conventionally attractive may not have had that opportunity.
Right.
And what Katie Nolan is saying is that doesn't devalue the work that those women have done. Rather, it highlights a really unfair standard on women to look a certain way.
Right.
Right? Not only do you have to be good at your job, all these women are great at their jobs. Katie Nolan is great at her job.
Right.
She is really good at what she does. She has great comedic timing. She knows sports. She knows how to engage with people. She gets it. Maria Taylor, fantastic at her job. These women are really good. The fact that there is also an expectation that they be beautiful is not one that is a privilege to them. It's one that's unfair to all women. The expectation that if you want to succeed in sports, you also have to be amazing looking.
Right.
When that expectation doesn't exist for men. And so what Katie Nolan's saying is like, hey, people throw out this argument about how, like, you know, you're lucky that you're pretty or whatever. But like, also, why is that a requirement for her?
Well, and also, I mean, let's just... I mean, there's so much about this that is that gets to untie. But let me just try one thing or to unwind. The idea that somehow there is this shortage anywhere of sufficiently good-looking people that you would need to auger toward good-looking as opposed to talented for some reason. You know what I mean? Like there are plenty of talented people not working and plenty of good-looking people not working. My guess is that there's a larger number of good-looking people who maybe aren't very good and a smaller number. I mean, so if you have this job, they are going to pick someone talented. There is no reason not to because that person hopefully is available. Now, does TV over-index on attractiveness? I don't think that's even arguable. Of course it does, with men and women. And I would say it's absolutely fundamentally less true with men. And I'd also say that they allow men to get to be 70 and keep that job.
Yep.
And you don't see that with women.
You don't see
it. Ever.
And I have such anxiety about aging. Every woman I know has anxiety about aging, particularly if you work in media.
Right.
I'm not even on TV. I'm on the radio and I write. There is like no incentive for me to look any kind of way.
Right.
And yet I have so much anxiety about it because even in people's, you know, the way that they consume information from women, there is an expectation that you be like, you know, just this like palatable presence.
Right.
And it's everywhere. Like that expectation seeps into everything, even not TV. And it's incredibly unfair. And to devalue these women because they meet that really ridiculous expectation of what they should look like is also just awful. And it ties into another thing I believe is just so tiring, which is comparing so many women to each other in sports.
Totally.
And it's especially tiring when that bar is so high.
Right.
So like Mina Kimes, I love Mina Kimes. She's a great writer. She's funny. She has great opinions. She's bold. She's quick-witted. I enjoy following her on Twitter for little quips just as much as I enjoy reading long-form writing from her. She is exceptionally accomplished. She went to Yale. She's like brilliant. She worked in business before she worked at ESPN. She's talented at her job, but her qualifications are also off the charts. It can feel like in so many ways, all of these women get compared to each other and it's impossible to match up with some of those expectations. Like, why isn't there also room for a woman that, like, didn't go to an Ivy League school? Like, why is it that, like, to be embraced, Mina Kimes doesn't need to have all of those accomplishments to be embraced. She shouldn't. She's so good at her job outside of those things. You know what I mean? Like, she has proven, regardless of her background, that she knows what she's doing. It seems weird that people use her background to give her legitimacy over other women.
I mean, I would say that I agree with you completely, but I would say and I agree with you, the shame of comparing, you know, it's the same old trope like in basketball. Why is it white players are compared with white players and black players are compared only with black players and women like why aren't they sports reporters compared to other sports reporters? And the thing I least like is when it comes to award time, it tends to be gender neutral. I mean, it tends to not be that. But I would also say to your argument about expectations of the people who do the hiring into television and into hiring into, you know, maybe radio to a lesser extent. Although really it's going to be, we're going to get to a place where those two things are completely merged. Right. I mean, because we do audio or video elements all the time. And so I'm not sure that there's going to be that delineation between the two forever. But I think I always have felt like it also kind of sells the viewers short as well, because I feel like if someone is good at their gig and they're funny and smart, I could not care less I literally have never tuned into sports ever once based on the attractiveness of anyone, male, female, athletic. It doesn't matter. It's never, ever mattered to me.
I don't buy this argument that it's like, I see it every time. Well, Aaron Andrews has to look a certain way and Maria Taylor has to look a certain way because they're selling to a male audience in football. How many of you have tuned into a game? Like, how many of you watched Monday Night Football specifically because you were like, maybe there's going to be a good looking sideline reporter? That's not why you watch. I don't buy that.
You watch your team. or you watch the team you want to watch or whatever. It's such garbage. That, to me, is the executives not understanding or giving anyone enough credit on who they want to watch.
Yeah.
And I would also say, I mean, I've made this argument about, since my expertise is not in professional sports, but it is a little bit more in the service industry, in bars, because I own one. And, you know, the way some bars hire, like, only with, like, 20-something attractive women because they think that that's what you need is garbage. We have a bartender who's 60. We had a bartender until recently who was in her 80s. You know, that was, it didn't create, there was no distinction. It's a friendly place. People went in there because they liked the place. They didn't go in there because we had some hot person who was either a great or terrible bartender. They went in there because they liked the whole thing. And I think that sports fans, generally speaking, I think are a lot more, I mean, you do get a lot of nasty, like, you know, social media stuff. I think every woman in sports does. But I would like to think that there is, to use the term silent majority, there's a lot of people out there who aren't like that. And I don't know that we get enough credit for just totally watching what we enjoy, reading whom we like. I read bylines. I mean, I look at who's written something just because I grew up in newspapers professionally. But generally speaking, So I tend to know who it is. Then I look them up maybe on Twitter and see what else they've done if I really like something. But I could not possibly care. I don't know what anyone looks mm-hmm. like, and I don't care.
Right.
And I always get completely flummoxed by this argument because it feels like I almost more blame the people who do the hiring and the executives than I do anyone else.
That's what Katie is saying in this argument. She's saying, like, first of all, again, I can't stress enough that I believe that both of these women are insanely talented. What Katie is saying is, like, why are you blaming the women for a problem that exists outside of them?
Right.
Like, it is
precisely
like they got in and still face a huge amount of scrutiny, even knowing their stuff.
Right.
And what she's saying is, like, why don't we make it more welcoming for all kinds of women, you know, regardless of, you know, race, age, anything like that. And it seems like this really unfair thing to just target her
right.
and blame her for having her job because she, you know, looks a certain way.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't walk in there and declare she owned the job. She got hired by somebody, somebody who had a criteria. And if that is their criteria, then, like, leave her alone.
I think people also have this weird expectation of, like, how far being good looking really gets you. Like, Katie Nolan wouldn't still be in her job if she didn't know what she was doing.
That was my point earlier.
Yeah.
There are plenty of good looking people out there. I see them every day. I mean, and some of them, I assume, are good-looking people. And it's also sort of in the eye of the beholder anyway. But
right.
But some of them are probably good at their jobs. Some of them are not good at their jobs. I bet none of them keeps their jobs because they're good-looking.
No, literally, you know? No one.
Right.
Literally, like, no one has ever been able to, like, be given the keys to a sideline gig or anything and just been like, yeah, wing it. I don't know. Just make sure you curl your hair. You look great.
I mean, look at how many. And if you are wondering about being good or not, and being connected or not keeps you a sideline job. Look how many former athletes have lost their gigs, mm-hmm. you know, in announcing. I don't have to go any farther than say, oh, Jason Witten, you know, who was awful.
It's hard to do.
It's hard to do. And he was great tight end, probably a nice guy, lousy in the booth. It's a very, very difficult job. There is not one person doing it at a high level holding that job.
Yeah.
And you know who gets it? Those are the ones who get the pass.
Yeah.
You know, when you had, I don't remember, I think it was Eric Dickerson who was not great on the sideline. I think he got better over time. But those are the people, and you see them sort of like gently kind of move them out and then move somebody else in because they want that athlete credibility. It is a difficult job,
and
they grew up in the sport.
And it doesn't get enough credit because it's primarily, I think when people think sideline, I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to where they're like, oh, do you want to be like a sideline reporter? First of all, there's nothing wrong with being a sideline reporter.
No.
It's an incredibly difficult job.
Absolutely.
It doesn't get enough credit. But I say that because people typically associate women with that job.
Right.
And because they associate women with it, people don't give that job the credit it deserves for
totally.
How hard it is to do. I've watched a friend of mine, a coworker, Jessamyn McIntyre, is a sideline reporter during the Wazoo Cougars football season. I've watched her there. I've seen her at rugby games. It is insane how hard she works, you know, to get that information and on a second's notice for the broadcast and the right questions to ask in the moment.
Prepping while you're following the actual
it's
action.
It's so difficult.
It's very difficult.
It's unreal, and it's a shame that it doesn't also get the credit it deserves for, you know, people too often just see women in that role and think like, oh, whatever, they're disposable. No, yeah. They're not.
No, they're not. And well, actually, good. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that one. I suspect, unfortunately, we're going to get a chance to talk about issues exactly like this more and more, but let's hope that we get a little break from it, that people start being
fingers
a little bit,
crossed, man. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I would love to talk about Seahawks. I'll talk about Seahawks anytime. Like, let's, you know.
I got to say, though, I hunger for these stories because I do like the intersection of sports and society. To me, that's almost more interesting than any of the sports themselves. But then I'm just, you know, I nerd out on that kind of stuff, too. But also, I think you do, too. Stacey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. You can ring my bell.
Rachel, one of the outgrowths of the pandemic has been, we know about the service industry, bars and restaurants shut down for a period of time, then opened up in a very limited way lately. Now there is a little bit of pushback on the 10 p.m. closing time. 10 p.m. essentially is the new 2 a.m., as it was explained to me. There's a petition out, I know, because I was one of the people who signed onto this petition. That's supposed to go to the governors. What's the status of this now? What's it all about?
Yeah, so restaurants can only operate at 50% capacity right now, which I think a lot of people know. Same with bars. And like you said, they cannot serve alcohol after 10 p.m. So for bars, that means they're just going to shut down. For restaurants, that means if you go in to get a late dinner, you can't have a glass of wine or a beer with that. So there's a guy named Dan Austin. He owns Flight Path, which is a bar in Burien, and Peel and Press, an Italian restaurant in West Seattle. And like you said, he wrote up a letter to Governor Inslee's office. He has about 150 signatures from other bar and restaurant owners, and they're all asking the governor to consider making a later, less call, basically.
We don't have data on it. We don't have evidence that says closing at these 2 hours because there's some sort of dangerous hours on top of the rest. And we do know that it's financially devastating. And this is kind of that line where like, hey, we've given up a ton to try to reopen and survive and to serve the community safely. But this one piece we got to ask a question about.
He says forcing bars to close at 10 p.m. automatically kills 30% of their business. And most restaurants and bars are already making, you know, 60 to 80% less than they were before COVID. But his argument is, hey, this is actually a safe environment. We're following all the protocols. We're cleaning the hard surfaces. We're keeping people 6 feet apart. Maybe this is safer than letting people drink out in the wild.
I bartend because I can't afford staff, so I bartend quite a bit. And when I call last call at 9:30, I start seeing the gatherings in the parking lot and the debate of whose house we're going to. So we're taking people out of a safe, regulated environment that follows all of the protocols that are required by the state, and we're sending them out into the wild of the house party or the house gathering. And that concerns me. There's transmission happening when you're in those environments, and you're killing business off to have someone go do something harmful when they could continue to do that in our location and be regulated by a sober staff.
And he's fine with it not being 2 a.m., but he wants some kind of compromise.
A great first step in this reopening process would be a 12 o'clock reopen. It's 2 extra hours. If we could get those 2 extra hours back, it would let us claw back quite a bit of our late night sales. And we're not busy late night. I don't want it to come across like that's when the bars are packed and it's a bar scene from Florida that you've seen photos of. It's still roughly 30 to 40% capacity, depending on location, with social distancing protocols. We need those hours back. I pay a lease for those hours. I can't generate income off of it. I pay insurance to cover those hours. I can't generate revenue off of it. And my staff relies on those hours to be able to pay their bills. And I can't pay them for hours that don't exist.
And it's not just bars. It's also restaurant owners. They are losing the late night dinner crowd when they can't sell a bottle of wine to accompany a nice meal.
Well, you came in to order at 9:15. And I'm going to drop a bottle down on you. You have 45 minutes to pound it or... And so customers don't come in when they know they can't have a glass of wine with their pasta and it's about closing time. Ethan Stoll and Tom Douglas both signed on with this as well. It's hurting their businesses in that aspect, but they can't get that third turn at the end of the night. And we need every possible 50% of our tables to be sat and utilized as much as we can.
So Dan sent out this letter more than a week ago. He hasn't heard back from the governor's office, but after several emails, I finally got an interview, not with the governor, but with someone from the office. So let's see, Nick Strully, he is executive director of external relations for Governor Inslee. And this was his response when I said, hey, you know, like, can you give an explanation? You know, there is no data. Bar owners at least want to know, what is the deal with this magic 10 o'clock number?
Many states, including Texas, Alabama, Pennsylvania, California, and Oregon, have placed restrictions on alcohol sales, including ending consumption earlier. And restaurants continue to be the number one non-healthcare outbreak setting in Washington state, with multiple new outbreaks announced every week. So, you know, that for us really gives us a pause for concern. And we have heard from local law enforcement and local public health during a series of roundtable discussions with colleges and college students about how helpful the alcohol consumption cutoff and specifically the bar restrictions have been in managing COVID transmission in those communities. So for all of those reasons, you know, we think what we've got is the right thing to have in place for now. But I always want to acknowledge that we're working tirelessly to try to find ways and look for opportunities and watch the data and look for trends to modify those restrictions and make sure that there's as much ability to have as much economic activity as possible.
So I'm torn on this because after I spoke with Dan, I was 100% on Dan's side. I was like, yeah, what's with this arbitrary number of 10 o'clock? And I understand, you know, the idea that when people are out late, maybe they get a little bit drunk and then it's hard to keep them separate and 6 feet apart or whatever. But the idea that people are just going to leave and then go to someone's house, you know, that's where transmissions can happen. But after hearing Nick say at the end here that restaurants have one of the highest rates of transmission, I'm like, oh, that's a good point, too. But I mean, then why not close restaurants down completely? Like, what's happening in the night that's not happening in the day?
I agree. I think that, and obviously I've got a bias. I signed on to this thing. I have a bar, so I experience this firsthand. I watch people, like Dan said, I watch people leave, walk across the street to Bartels, pick up 12 packs of White Claw or whatever beer that they like, and I'll go to a park or someone's house and hang out for the rest of the evening. I do think that if what you're trying to say is that booze makes people make bad decisions, and I think too much booze does make people make bad decisions. I mean, I'm in the business. I understand that. Then stop booze sales at 10. I mean, if that's what you're actually blaming, if you're blaming food sales, well, then you would need to put that restriction on every bit of food sales, but you're not. What you're blaming is booze sales, essentially. You're saying that the mixture of people and booze creates an environment. Stop the booze sales at 10. Or I can see Dan's point. I don't think anything is going to change. And here, there's a couple of reasons why. One, I think that there is a component. I mean, we are aggressively cleaning all the time. We, you know, and so far, I think we've been careful and we've been lucky. I think anyone who says it's just careful and not lucky is not being honest with you. But I know that Great Britain is walking back its reopening of pubs and they're going to go to early closures. And I know that Anthony Fauci today said that bars and restaurants are still a vector. So I can't imagine that regardless of Dan's petition and the things that we may see that we feel are contradictory within it, or at least unexplained, it's probably not going to change anytime soon.
Yeah. In the statement, the governor's office initially said they were very blunt and said it is not going to change anytime soon.
Right.
So that's the answer right there. Yeah. I mean, personally, I'm in the camp that I haven't been eating inside of restaurants. You know, I'll sit outside. And I think, you know, I did mention to Nick when we spoke, I said, well, maybe there's a difference between bars and restaurants, because if you're worried, you know, he mentioned college students, if you're worried about kind of the bar atmosphere, I understand that, but why couldn't two people sitting at a table at a restaurant order a bottle of wine, you know? So I don't know if the restaurants and the bars need to have different protocols.
Well, I mean, again, if you're going to link it to alcohol sales, simple. Everyone, the fact that 7-Eleven can sell, we were allowed to sell booze to go. That was a gesture to make us a little bit more financially solvent. But so can 7-Eleven sell booze to go, and so can Bartels, and so can Safeway and whomever else. Why not just stop alcohol sales at 10 p.m.? If you really, I mean, if you really feel like that's the problem, then make make it universally the solution. And that way, I don't watch people decamp and go across the street and buy from someone else. What you've really decided is here are the winners in the booze sales, late night booze sales, and here are the losers in the late night booze sales.
Yeah, you got to plan ahead, buddy.
That's kind of what the governor is saying in this case. It's his obviously. His prerogative to do so. I don't want to see the coronavirus spread any more than it has. So I get it, but it seems like that would be a fair outcome.
Yeah. I think that we obviously are the worst country in the world right now in regards to this. And so I think we've already gone too far. I don't know what we can do, but obviously we're not doing good with COVID. So I think anything that can keep the numbers down is a good thing. I feel for every bar and restaurant.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
It is awful, but if it really is going to make a difference, then I agree with the 10 p.m. cutoff.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. Don't kill me, Dan. Sorry. I was on your side for like 24 hours.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights, evening drawing to a close. Thank you for joining us tonight. This is where we get the last, it's like taking out the trash late at night. Our last little bit of what's left in our heads after spitting it out all evening here at Cairo. Shane, what's on your mind?
I had probably one of the hardest life lessons ever today.
Oh, yes.
Yesterday, I was complaining that I had, a crack in my tooth at the end of the show. And I was like, I'm going to go to the dentist tomorrow. I hate the dentist. I fear the worst. And the worst happened. I need a root canal. I need 3 crowns. I need 2 fillings. And it's all in total of about $7,000 worth of work. And I have no money. And that's more than half of what I have in student loan debt. So, trying to figure out how to make that possible.
Wow.
So that's basically just been on my mind all day. It's been a rough one.
Oh, that's awful. Man, I am so sorry. And the worst thing is, the dental stuff, it doesn't go away. It's not like you can sit around and have it heal. It just, it's just going to nag at you.
Yeah, it's the creaky wheel. I can't keep doing it for too much longer.
No, that's awful, man.
Truly.
I will give you one piece of advice. If you go to a dentist and say you are uninsured for dental work, some of them will actually give you a break. And some of them will find a way to make it as cheap as possible for
you. Yeah, that's true.
So definitely get multiple opinions on that if you can. Frank, what's on your mind?
I don't have anything nearly that significant. Tonight I'm going to go home and I'm going to finish the first Iron Man movie. I have seen all these films.
Oh, I'm sure you have.
But I made the commitment months ago that I was going to go back and watch all of the Marvel movies.
In order?
Started to, and then over the weekend I decided I had to see Infinity War and Endgame again. So I may watch those again at the end. But I started with Captain America: First Avenger. But now, starting with Iron Man 1, I am going to go through them in order. And so I was startled over the weekend, and again with Iron Man. These are really, really well done films.
The first Iron Man was dynamite. I thought it was maybe the best of all of them. I really liked it.
And the thing that's consistent, and it was especially true in watching Endgame and in Infinity War, how much time they spend with the characters.
Yeah.
How much time they take to make you care about these individuals who happen to also be superheroes. Really important component of Marvel Comics. They pull it off every time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm knocked out by it.
Absolutely. What is on my mind? Actually, it's been sort of a lot of stuff's been rattling around in there. But I would say that today, again, I always dig. I've said this before on what's on my mind, and it tends to be still on my mind. I always like it when I get a chance to talk to somebody who knows a lot about something. That, to me, is one of the greatest delights of this job. And talking about, I didn't know a whole lot about ranked voting. I know that Pierce County did an experiment on it. I think people in Pierce County, at least from the text messages, didn't feel like it turned out well. But I like the idea, when it's implemented well, this idea that you're ranking the whole slate of candidates in a given office. And conceivably, if no one gets a majority of number ones, of first place votes, then it goes down to like a lot of people's second choice. And I actually kind of like that as an idea, because it means that you actually have the freedom to vote for who you want, even if you don't think they're going to win, but you want to register your vote for that person. And then you can pick sort of the compromise person. That's what most people do. And in places where it's well done, and I'm not saying it was in Pierce County, I'm not saying it wasn't. I don't know enough about what they did down there. But I like the idea that it changes, apparently when they study it, it changes the actual politics. Like, people then don't go for the polls. They don't go for polarizing, really bombastic politicking. They try to appeal to a lot of people, so they could end up as two or three, maybe, even if they're not one. And it really starts changing the language, and I think that that language change would be a relief and a benefit to all of us. So from all of us here at Cairo, thank you again for joining us, and we will see you tomorrow. Take a look all around, and I'll be there. I'm sorry, but I'm just thinking of the ride with the sun. I promise. I know they don't sound the way I planned them to be. But if you wait around the wall, I'll make you fall for me. I promise. I promise you I will. When your day. So if you tremble, you know what to do. I'm gonna always be there. Sometimes if I shout, it's not what's intended. These words just come out.